Even if he's not exactly doing much for his reputation right now, is there someone I could talk to? Anna Palmer here is supposed to be pretty good. It depends what you're after. She hasn't got Eric's experience when it comes to psychological trauma and states of shock, of course. Nelly leads Yuna along the corridor, but after a little while she slows down and asks him if she's in danger. I can't answer that, Yuna replies honestly. My husband's working late all week. You should ask for police protection. No, not police protection. This is all too much. It's just that we noticed that the lock at the back of the house was damaged yesterday. Have you got someone you can go and stay with? Yes, of course, she says, blushing slightly. Do that until this is over. I'll think about it. Chapter 102. Anna Palmer sees Yuna in a small book-lined room. There's a desk and a narrow window overlooking the hospital grounds. She's a tall woman with short, lead-grey hair and visible veins beneath her eyes. I know someone who was in a car accident 10 years ago, Yuna begins. He suffered fairly severe brain damage. This isn't my area, obviously, but the way it's been explained to me, he suffers from ongoing epileptic activity in the temporal lobes of both sides of his brain. That can certainly happen, she says, jotting down what he says. His big problem is his memory, Yuna goes on. Short and long term. Sometimes he remembers every detail of an event. Sometimes he forgets that it ever took place. I'm hoping that hypnosis might help him break through the barriers. Anna Palmer lowers her notepad and folds her hands on the desk. Yuna notices tiny red eczema scabs on her knuckles. I don't want to disappoint you, she says in a weary tone of voice, but a lot of people have unrealistic expectations about what hypnosis can be used for. It's very important for this person to remember, Yuna replies. Clinical hypnosis is about making suggestions as a sort of internal self-help, and it's nothing to do with revealing truths, she explains apologetically. But this sort of brain injury doesn't mean that his memory has been erased. It's all there. It's just that the path to it is blocked. I mean, couldn't hypnosis help him to find a different path? It would certainly be possible to get to that point if you were very skillful, she concedes, scratching the red marks on her hands. But what do you do when you get there? No one would be able to differentiate between his real memories and his imagination, seeing as his brain can't tell the difference. Are you sure? I mean, we think we can tell the difference between memory and imagination. We are convinced that we can, because we store certain information together with an awareness that those are genuine memories, like a sort of code, an introductory note, a prefix. So, shouldn't that code still be in his brain? Yuna persists. But extracting that at the same time as his memories, she says, shaking her head. Is there anyone who could do that? No, she replies, closing her notepad. Eric Maria Bark claims he can. Eric is very good at... He's probably the best person in the world at putting patients into a state of deep hypnosis. But his research isn't evidence-based, she says slowly, and there's a glint of something in her eyes. Do you believe what the papers have been saying about him? I have no way of judging that. But he does have a leaning towards the perverse, the psychotic. She stops herself. Is this conversation actually about him? She asks bluntly. No. But it's not about a friend of yours, is it?
It never is. I'm a detective with the National Criminal Investigation Department, and I need to question a witness suffering from organic memory loss.
The corners of Anna Palmer's mouth twitch.
That would be unethical, seeing as anything said under hypnosis is the opposite of reliable and has no place in a legal context, she says curtly.
This is about detective work, not
I can promise you that no serious practitioner of clinical hypnosis would do this, she says, raising her voice and looking him in the eye.
Chapter 103. Eric walks across the bridge at Sikla with his cap pulled down and his head lowered. Then makes his way around the heights of Hammarbybacken, where Benjamin learned to ski, and heads into the forest. It's practically impossible to move in Stockholm without getting caught on camera. There are speed cameras along the roads, cameras monitoring the boundary of the congestion charging zone, traffic surveillance cameras at junctions, tunnels, and bridges. There are security cameras in shops, trains, buses, ferries and taxis. 24 hours a day petrol stations, car parks, harbours, terminals, railway stations and platforms are monitored. Banks, department stores, shopping centres, plazas, pedestrianised streets, embassies, police stations, prisons, hospitals, fire stations are all watched. Eric is extremely tired, and the blisters on the soles of his feet burst as he makes his way through the forest towards Björkhagen. The sky is growing dark, and Eric feels his legs shake when he stops in the little park behind the house where Nestor, his former patient, lives. Eric follows the path to a wooden door with a tarnished bronze letterbox. The color of the building reminds him of wet foam rubber. There's a light on in the kitchen on the ground floor. From here, he can see right into Nestor's living room. Eric switches windows and sees Nestor sitting in an armchair. There's no sign of anyone else in the flat. Eric's hands are shaking, and he feels as though he can't take another step as he rings the front door.
"Can I come in?" he asks as soon as Nestor opens the door.
"This is unexpected," Nestor mutters. "I'll put some coffee on."
Nestor lets Eric in, closes and locks the door, then disappears inside the flat. Eric takes his shoes off with a sigh, hangs up his crumpled jacket and smells his own sweat. His socks have stuck to his bleeding heels and his cold fingertips are itching in the heat of the hallway. He knows that Nestor lives in the same flat he grew up in. The ceilings are low, and the oak parquet floor is so old that the varnish has worn off. There are dog-shaped ornaments everywhere. Eric walks through the living room. The single cushion on the sofa is threadbare, and on the low table are a pair of glasses and a crossword, beside a large figurine of hunting dogs and dead pheasants. In the kitchen, Nestor is setting out cups and a plate of biscuits. There's a frying pan containing sausage and potatoes on the stove.
"You told me I could ask for a favor."
"Anything at all," Eric says, sitting down at the table.
"Yes," Nestor says, nodding emphatically. "Can I stay here for a few days?"
"Here?" A skeptical, boyish smile flits across Nestor's face.
"What for?"
"I've had a bit of a row with my girlfriend," Eric lies, leaning back.
"You've got a girlfriend?"
"Yes," Eric replies. Nestor pours coffee into their cups and says he has a spare room with a guest bed already made up. "Could I have some of the food that's left over?"
Of course, I'm sorry," he says, switching the hot plate on.
"You don't have to warm it up for me," Eric says.
"Don't you want—"
"No, it's fine." Nestor scrapes the food onto a plate and puts it in front of Eric before sitting down opposite him.
Have you thought any more about getting a dog? Eric asks.
I need to save up some money, Nestor replies, lifting his coffee spoon a few millimeters and surreptitiously looking at his reflection.
Of course, Eric says as he eats.
I work over there at the church, Nestor says, gesturing towards the window.
At the church? Eric asks, feeling a shiver spread down his spine.
Yes, well, not really, Nestor smiles, holding one hand in front of his mouth. I work in the pet cemetery.
The pet cemetery? Eric nods politely, looking at Nestor's slender hands and the yellowing polyester shirt under his pullover. Eric finishes the food and drinks his coffee as he listens to Nestor telling him about the oldest cemetery for domestic pets in Sweden, over on Djurgården. It was established when the author, Auguste Blanche, buried his dog there in the 19th century.
I'm boring you, Nestor says, getting to his feet.
No, I'm tired, that's all, Eric says. Nestor goes over to the window and looks out. Black shapes are moving against the paler sky, trees and bushes blowing back and forth.
It will soon be dark, Nestor whispers to his reflection.
There are two greyhounds on the windowsill next to a pot plant. Nestor touches their heads out of sight of Eric.
Can I use the bathroom? Eric asks.
Nestor shows him through the living room and points to an extra door behind a curtain.
This is the old caretaker's flat, but I think of that door as an emergency exit, he says.
The bathroom has tiles halfway up its walls, with a deep bathtub and a shower curtain with seahorses on it. Eric locks the door and takes his clothes off.
The red toothbrush is Mother's, Nestor calls through the door.
Eric stands on the moldy shower mat in the scratched bathtub, showers and washes the wounds on his body. On top of the bathroom cabinet above the basin is an old light bulb box. Some lipsticks and a mascara pen stick out from it. When Eric emerges, Nestor is standing in the hall waiting for him. His wrinkled face looks worried.
I'd really like to talk about something. It's something that...
he begins.
What is it? What do I do if the new dog dies?
We can talk about that tomorrow.
I'll show you to the guest room, Nestor whispers, turning his face away.
They go back into the living room again, past the kitchen to a closed door that Eric hasn't noticed before because it's on the far side of a cupboard. Above the bed in the spare room is a large poster of Bjorn Borg kissing the Wimbledon trophy. On the wall opposite is a shelf full of porcelain dogs. There's an old corner cupboard painted in traditional folk art style. The top door is decorated with a hand-painted motif, the ages of man, from cradle to grave. A man and woman stand side by side on a bridge, where each step represents a decade. On the top step, the pair stand tall as 50-year-olds, but death lurks beneath the bridge in the form of a skeleton with a scythe in his hand.
That's lovely, Eric says, looking at Nestor, who is still standing in the living room.
I sleep in Mother's room. I moved in there when... Nestor cranes his neck oddly, as if he wanted to look at someone standing behind him.
Good night, Eric says.
He takes hold of the door handle to close it, but Nestor puts his hand on the door and looks at him with anxious eyes.
The rich need it. The poor already have it, but you fear it more than death. Nestor whispers. I'm a bit too tired for riddles, Nestor.
The rich need it. The poor already have it. But you fear it more than death,
Nestor repeats, then licks his lips. I'll think about the answer, Eric says, and closes the door. Well, good night.
Eric sits down and stares at the hideous wallpaper with its repeated pattern that looks like ornate coats of arms, garlands, peacock feathers, and hundreds of eyes. The roller blind is already closed, and he switches the light off and detects a faint smell of lavender as he folds back the heavy covers and gets into bed. He's so exhausted that all his thoughts drift away and lose their shape. He's just about to tumble over the boundary into sleep when he hears a small creaking sound in the room. Someone is trying to open the door quietly.
What is it, Nestor? Eric asks.
A clue, the soft voice says. I can give you a clue.
I'm very tired, and
priests think it's bigger than God himself,
Nestor interrupts. Can you close the door, please? The handle clicks as Nestor lets go of it and pads away across the parquet in the living room. Eric falls asleep, and in his dreams, little Madeleine is standing by his bed, blowing on his face, and whispering the answer to Nestor's riddle.
Nothing, she whispers, blowing on him. The rich need nothing. The poor have nothing, and you fear nothing more than death.
Chapter 104.
Eric is pulled from sleep by a breeze on his face. Someone is whispering quickly, but stops the moment he opens his eyes. The darkness is almost impenetrable, and it takes him a few seconds before he realizes where he is. The old horsehair mattress creaks when he rolls over. Even if he was fast asleep, some part of him was alert, a force that yanked him from sleep. Perhaps he just heard water running through the building's pipes, or the wind pressing against the window. No one has been whispering in his room. Everything is still and dark. Eric wonders if this was where Nestor was sleeping when he slipped into psychosis, when the rattling of the pipes turned into voices, into the old woman brushing dandruff from her long grey hair, who told him you shouldn't look your nearest and dearest in the eye when you kill them. Eric knows it was all about the dog Nestor was forced to put down when he was a child. But he still used to shiver every time Nestor imitated the woman's creaking voice. He thinks of the way Nestor used to sit with his hands clasped in his lap and his head lowered. A little smile would play on his lips, and he would flush slightly as he dispensed advice on how to murder a child. The old cupboard creaks, and the shadows by the door are hard to interpret. He closes his stinging eyes and goes back to sleep, but wakes up again immediately when the door to the guest room closes. Eric thinks that he's going to have to tell Nestor to leave him alone when he's sleeping, that he doesn't have to keep checking on him. But he can't be bothered to get up now. A car passes on the street outside, and its chill light finds its way past the roller blind, slides across the patterned wallpaper, and disappears. Eric stares at the wall. It looks like a trace of the light has been left on the wall once the car has gone. He thinks that there must be a weak lamp by the shelf that he hasn't seen before. Eric blinks, stares at the motionless blue light, and realizes that there's a peephole between the rooms. The light is coming from the other bedroom, Eric thinks, when everything suddenly goes dark. Nestor is looking onto his room right now. Eric lies absolutely still. It's so quiet that he can hear himself swallow. The blue light becomes visible again, and he can hear intense whispering through the wall. Eric quickly gets dressed in the darkness and moves closer to the light. The point of light is between the two lower shelves of the bookcase. The little hole would be invisible if the porcelain animals were arranged differently. It's positioned in the very darkest part of the pattern on the wallpaper, so small that he realizes he's going to have to press his face to the wall and put his eye right next to the hole to be able to see anything. He moves a porcelain puppy in a basket, leans his hands on the wall, and carefully puts his head between the shelves, feeling the wood against his hair and the wallpaper touching the tip of his nose. When he is right next to the hole, he can see straight into the next room. There's a mobile phone on the bedside table. The screen is lit up, illuminating the alarm clock and the oval pattern of the wallpaper. Eric manages to catch a glimpse of the neatly made bed and a framed photograph of a young child in a christening gown before the light from the phone goes out. He hears rapid footsteps somewhere in the flat and tries to pull his head back, but his hair catches on a splinter in the wood. The porcelain figures tinkle ominously. Eric puts his hand up and tries to free his hair as the door opens behind him. He pulls his head out and hears the figurines on the shelf rattle. Nestor comes towards him, and he backs away.
"I've called the police. I came back to tell you," Nestor whispers. "It's your turn to get help now. I've spoken to them several times. They're here now."
"Nestor, you don't understand," Eric says forlornly.
"No, no, you don't understand," Nestor interrupts in a friendly voice and switches on the lamp in the window. "I said it's your turn to get medicine and..."
There's a sudden noise, like a stone hitting the window. The dark roller blind quivers in the light from the lamp, and a cascade of glass falls down behind the blind and tinkles over the radiator. Nestor lurches. He's been shot right through his body with a high-velocity weapon. Blood sprays out of the exit hole in his shoulder. He looks at the blood in surprise.
"They promised..."
He stumbles, falls onto his hip, and looks up with a confused expression.
"Get out through the extra door," he hisses. "Go down into the laundry room, straight through, and you'll be in the next building."
He puts his knuckles on the floor as if to push himself up.
"Lie down," Eric whispers. "Just lie flat. Run across the schoolyard, then follow the church wall to the forest and the pet cemetery. Lie still," Eric repeats, then runs at a crouch towards the door.
When he reaches the living room, he hears Nestor's front door being forced open. There's a crash, and splinters and pieces of metal from the lock clatter across the floor.
"Hide in the little red house," Nestor gasps behind him.
Eric turns round and sees that Nestor has stood up to point. The glass in front of Bjorn Borg's smiling face explodes, and the echo of a shot resounds between the buildings. Nestor is holding one hand against the side of his neck as a torrent of blood pulses out between his fingers. Three of the flat's windows shatter, and distraction grenades explode, flashing with such ferocity that time seems to stand still. Eric staggers backwards. The silence is like a sandy beach. Slow waves roll in, then pull back with a crackle. He feels his way through the living room, unable to see anything but the freeze-frame image of the bedroom with Nestor's silhouette against the window, and the drops of blood hanging in the air in front of the cupboard door, with death hiding under a bridge. Eric's hearing has been knocked out,
but he feels further blasts as waves of pressure against his chest. He walks straight into the battered sofa and feels his way along its back. Then the shock lifts. His eyes are working again, and he makes his way round the table and magazine rack. But he's still as giddy as if he were very drunk. Lights from guns sweep round the hall and kitchen. His ears start to ring, but he still can't hear anything around him. He locates the extra door behind the curtain, unlocks it, and creeps out into the back stairwell. He almost trips over the first step, but grabs hold of the handrail. He makes his way downstairs on unsteady feet, then walks until he reaches a metal door and finds himself in the laundry room. He feels his way along the wall until his fingers make contact with a light switch, turns the lights on, and hurries past washing machines, trolleys, and bins full of empty bottles as he tries to remember what Nestor said. His head feels strangely detached, as if none of this really concerns him. His temporary blindness lingers as silvery spots. Any light source stronger than 5 million candelas activates all the photocells in the eye, meaning that everything you see after being dazzled seems to happen slightly out of sync. At the end of the long corridor is a door, and he runs up a narrow flight of steps and finds himself in a different stairwell. Eric walks out into the cool night air. There are no emergency vehicles on this side of the block. Presumably, the rapid response unit are some distance away. Eric hurries through the little park. In the cold, he can feel that one of his ears is wet. He touches his cheek and realizes that he's bleeding. Without looking round, he walks straight across Karlskronavegen and past a car park and some dirty recycling bins. Broken glass crunches beneath his feet. The tarmacked schoolyard is empty. A beer can rolls in the wind. The basketball hoops on their posts have no nets. High above, a helicopter is approaching. The clatter of the rotors is audible across the rooftops, and Eric realizes that his hearing is starting to come back. He walks on more slowly, gasping for breath, then creeps round the building and in amongst the trees. It's almost pitch black here. Eric holds his hands out in front of his face to protect himself from branches until he sees the low church wall. Fear is beginning to catch up with him as he follows the wall through tall nettles. Deep within the forest, there's a sudden concentration of tiny graves decorated by children. He sees headstones with dogs' collars hanging off them, graves with squeezy toys, drawings, photographs and flowers, homemade crosses or painted stones, burned-out candles, and sooty lanterns. Chapter 105. It's past 2 o'clock in the morning, but Yuna is standing in the middle of his room at the Hotel Hanson. The floor is covered with photographs from the crime scenes and postmortems. Because Eric's house is out of bounds for the duration of the search, the police have sent him to a hotel. His jacket and pistol are lying on the untouched bed. He's had a Caesar salad in his room. The remains are under the shiny metal dome on the low coffee table. As Yuna reads the forensic expert's analyses of the crime scenes, he compares them with the pictures, post-mortem reports, and test results from the National Forensics Laboratory. Rocky's nightmares were genuine memories. Everything he said under hypnosis was true. The same murderer has returned. The unclean preacher has started killing again. After the murder of Rebecca Hanson, the serial killer went into a long cooling-off period. He waited in a state of cold storage until the next escalation began. For a stalker, following someone is like a drug addiction.
It's impossible to stop. He has to get closer, make contact, give gifts, and as time passes, develops a real relationship with them inside his own head. Outwardly, he can exhibit submissive gratitude, but in actual fact, he is extremely resentful and jealous. The police have a list of almost 700 names who fit the basic outline of the perpetrator profile. Bishops, pastors, priests, and members of their families, deacons, church wardens, caretakers, undertakers, preachers, and faith healers. Yuna believes that the perpetrator is intentionally trying to make it look like Eric is guilty of the murders, but he can't find any connection between Eric and any of the men on the list. What Yuna is looking for now, among the reports and analysis, is something definite that will allow him to cross most of the names off the list. There's nothing that stands out in the material, but perhaps different elements could be combined in an unexpected way. Yuna tries separating the pieces of the puzzle and seeing if there are other ways of putting them together. He walks across to the pictures of the deer's head and a tub of melted ice cream and stops in front of the photograph of Sandra Lundgren's murder weapon. The stained knife was photographed where it was found, on the floor beside her dead body. The flash from the camera shimmers like a dark sun in the brown blood. He reads that it is a chef's knife with a stainless steel blade that's 20 centimeters long, and then examines Erickson's careful sketches, attempting to reconstruct the brutal process of the attack from blood traces and spatter patterns. The perpetrator has worn the same footwear each time, touring boots, size 43. Yuna tries to identify clues that have been missed, things that don't match the overall picture. He pores over picture after picture and stops in front of a photograph with the number 311. A blue pottery fragment that resembles a bird's skull, with white bubbles along one edge and a sharp point that's smooth as ice. He leafs forward to the item in Erickson's report and reads that it was tucked between the cracks in Sandra's floor and was only found when low-level light was shone across the floor. According to the laboratory analysis, the tiny 2-millimeter-long fragment consists of glass, iron, sand, and chamotte clay. Yuna moves to the report from Adam Youssef's home. In spite of the gunfire, the murderer chose to go through with his plan. And according to the preliminary report, Katrina was missing the false fingernails from both her hands. The preacher takes trophies, then marks the places he's taken them from with the victim's hands, like a judgment in a trial. At 3:15, Anya Larsson calls to say that she has just been informed about an imminent operation. The police have received a tip-off that is regarded as highly credible. A man claims that Eric is sleeping in the spare room in his flat. Eric had been his psychiatrist some years ago.
The man has been told to leave the flat.
Who's leading the operation? Yuna asks.
Daniel Frick.
He's one of Adam's best friends. I understand what you're saying, Anya says, but I don't think there's anything to worry about, because this operation is still being led by the National Response Unit.
Yuna goes over to the window and looks down at the hire car he's left parked on the pavement, rather than in the hotel's garage. It's a gunmetal grey Porsche with 6 cylinders and 560 horsepower.
Where's the flat? Because everyone knows that I'm loyal to you, Margot has decided that I should be kept outside the current investigation. And she's got a point, because if I knew the address, I'd tell you.
Anya doesn't know where the operation is going to take place,
but she's worked out that it must be somewhere south of Stockholm. She says the response unit has been given permission to use pump-action shotguns, assault rifles, repeaters, and PSG-90 sniper rifles. After the call, Yuna stands and gazes at the floor of the hotel room. Hundreds of pictures lined up in rows from wall to wall, with the floor lamp reflecting off the glossy surface of the photographs. He carries on reading Ericsson's crime scene analysis, but his mind keeps wandering to Erik and the impending operation. Yuna walks to the other side of the room, looks at a picture of a fragment of yellow fiber, then reads a lab report about a piece of trampled leaf left on the kitchen floor in Maria Karlsson's home. It turned out to be a fragment of stinging nettle. He looks at the enlargement on the photograph. The tiny piece of leaf fills the whole sheet of paper like a spiky green tongue. The hairs look like crystal needles or fragile pipettes. Dawn comes, and the sky in the east grows paler. Narrow streaks of sunlight filter past chimneys and gables, over the roofs and copper ornaments of Vasastan. The operation must be over by now, Yuna thinks, and calls Erik on his new phone. He tries a second time, but gets no answer. Even though it's only 5:30 in the morning, he decides to call Margot. He has to know if they've caught Erik, but can't ask straight out about the operation because he doesn't want to get Anya in trouble. "Have you managed to arrest an innocent suspect yet, then?"
"Yuna, I'm asleep."
"I know, but what's going on?"
"What's going on? You're not actually allowed to ask. But a former patient of Eric's called and said that Erik was in his flat," she replies in a tired voice.
"Can I have a name?"
"Confidential. I can't talk to you. I told you that. Just say if it's something I ought to know about." "The patient told the police he'd left Erik alone in the flat. The National Response Unit went in, saw an armed man, and shot live ammunition. It turned out that the person in the window was the patient, who had returned to the flat."
"And Erik wasn't there?"
He can hear her trying to sit up in bed.
"We don't even know if he'd been there at all. And the patient's on an operating table right now and can't be interviewed. Or what if he's the preacher?"
Yuna interrupts. "Erik's guilty. But maybe the patient knows where he is. We'll question him as soon as we can. You should station armed guards at the hospital."
"Yuna, we've found blood in Erik's car. It might not mean anything, but it's been sent for analysis."
"Have you looked for a set of yellow rain clothes in the patient's flat?"
"We didn't find anything special," she replies.
"Are there stinging nettles outside the flat?"
"No, I don't think so," she says in a bemused tone.
Chapter 106. Yuna sits down on a chair for the first time in several hours and reads more about the killer's steps in Sandra Lundgren's flat, looks at the sketches, and thinks that there's something unusually agitated and frenetic about the murders. They're planned, but they aren't rational. Yuna compares this with the post-mortem report's description of theatrical aggression, but can't help thinking that the degree of controlled preparation is actually a disguise, and that the aggression itself is the perpetrator's natural state. He is about to make a note to investigate the medical history of Erik's former patient when his phone rings.
"Yuna, it's me," Erik whispers. "They tried to kill me. I was hiding out at Nestor's. He's an old patient of mine. The police must have thought it was me they could see in the window. They shot him twice. It was like an execution.
I didn't think the police in Sweden could do something like that. It's completely insane.
Are you somewhere safe now?
Yes, I think so. You know, he only came back to tell me what he'd done, to say that the police had promised not to hurt me, and then they shot him through the window.
Has it occurred to you that he could be the preacher?
He isn't, Eric replies instantly. What was his problem when he was Yuna? That doesn't matter. I just want a trial. I don't care if they convict me. I can't stay Eric.
I don't think I'm being monitored, but don't tell me where you are, Yuna interrupts. I only want to know how long you can stay hidden where you are.
The phone crackles as Eric moves.
I don't know. 24 hours, maybe? He whispers. There's a tap here, but nothing to eat.
Are you likely to be found?
There's probably not much risk of that, Eric replies, then falls silent.
Eric?
I don't understand how I could have ended up in this situation, he says quietly. Everything I've done has only made things worse.
I'm going to find the preacher, Yuna says.
It's too late for that. It's too late for everything now. I just want to give myself up without being killed.
Yuna can hear Eric's agitated breathing down the phone.
If we manage to hand you over and keep you alive in prison, these crimes carry a life sentence, Yuna says.
But I don't think I'd be convicted. I can hypnotize Rocky before the trial.
They'd never let you do that.
No, maybe not, but
I went to see Rocky, Yuna says. He's in Hudinga prison for possession of drugs. He remembered you, but nothing about the zone or the preacher.
It's hopeless, Eric says.
Yuna leans against the window and feels the cool glass against his forehead. Down in the street, a taxi stops outside the hotel. The driver's face is grey with tiredness as he walks round the car to take the luggage out. Yuna glances down at his hire car, watches the taxi drive off, and when he looks up again, he's made up his mind.
I'll try to find a way of getting Rocky out today, and then we'll meet up so you can hypnotize him, he says.
Is that your plan? Eric asks.
You said you could unearth specific details about the preacher if you were able to hypnotize Rocky again.
Yes, I can. I'm pretty sure of that.
In that case, I'll be able to find the real killer while you stay in hiding.
I just want to hand myself in, and you'll be found guilty if it goes to trial.
That's ridiculous. I just happened to be nearby when...
It's not just that, Yuna interrupts.
Your fingerprints were on an object found in Susanna Kern's hand.
What object? Eric asks in astonishment.
Part of a porcelain animal.
I don't get it. That doesn't mean anything to me.
But the fingerprint match is 100%.
Yuna hears Eric walk up and down. It sounds as though he's walking across a wooden floor.
So, everything points at me, he says in a low voice.
Have you got a picture of Nestor?
Eric tells him how to log into the medical records of the psychology clinic before they end the call. Yuna puts his pistol and jacket on, then goes down to reception to get a printout of Nestor's picture before leaving the hotel room again. He walks past his hire car and turns into the much narrower Freigatan. Outside one of the doorways stands an old Volvo, the sort with no ignition lock. Yuna looks round quickly. The street is completely deserted. He takes a step back, then kicks in the rear side window. The alarm of a car further down the street goes off. Yuna opens the front door from the inside, moves the seat back, pulls his screwdriver out of his pocket, prizes off the cover around the ignition and loosens the panels on the steering column. He leans over and inserts the screwdriver into the upper part of the column and carefully breaks the steering lock. Quickly, he pulls on a pair of gloves, gets in the driving seat, loosens the red cables on the ignition cylinder, and peels back their plastic covering. As soon as he twists the ends together, music starts to play on the radio, and the inside light comes on. He shuts the door, pulls out the brown wires, and puts them together, and the engine starts. The streets aren't yet full of cars as he drives out to Hudinger. A plastic rosary hangs off the rearview mirror. There are already lorries on the road, but the commuters are still drinking coffee in their homes. In Hudinger, he drives past the imposing prison building and carries on south, pulls onto a track leading into the forest, turns the car round, parks, then starts walking back towards Stockholm. Chapter 107. Juna Linna gets out of the taxi on Surbrunnsgatan, pays and walks across the street to his grey hire car. The engine starts with a gentle hum. He leans back in the leather seat and pulls away from the curb. When he reaches Hudinger prison, he parks right in front of the entrance, next to a metal fence, and calls Eric's number. "How are you getting on?" he asks. "Okay. But I'm starting to get hungry." "I've changed my SIM card, so you can tell me where you are now." "Behind St. Mark's Church, outside the wall. There's a pet cemetery in the woods. I'm hiding in a red wooden shed." "That's fairly close to the police raid on Nestor's flat, isn't it?" "Yes, I heard the ambulance last night," Eric says quietly. "I'll bring Rocky out to you. An hour from now," Juna says, glancing up at the imposing edifice of the prison. He puts his pistol and mobile in the glove compartment, leaves the key in the ignition, and then gets out of the car and walks in through the tall pillars. He buys 3 sandwiches at the kiosk, asks for a bag, and then goes over to say why he's there. After going through the usual security procedures, Juna is shown inside the prison. The same prison officer as before is standing waiting for him. Juna notes that Arne has a telescopic baton from Bunavi. It's made of sprung steel and designed to hit the muscles in the upper arms and thighs. His name badge sits slightly crookedly on his pilled NATO sweater. His handcuffs are dangling from his belt at the base of his broad back. In the lift, Arne takes off his glasses and polishes them on his sweater. "How's the fishing?" Juna asks.
"I'm heading to Elf Karleby with my brother-in-law later this autumn."
The interview room is one of the monitored rooms in which one wall consists of a pane of glass, making it possible for people in the next room to observe everything going on inside. Juna sits down on a chair and waits, with both hands resting on the tabletop, until he hears voices approaching along the corridor.
"He's called the Naked Chef because he was naked when he started," the duty officer is saying as the door opens and Rocky is led into the room.
"No," Arne says, "that's not right. My wife and I saw Jamie Oliver at the book fair in Gothenburg 15 years ago. He was completely naked, stood there making spaghetti alla vongole."
"My shoulders hurt," Rocky sighs.
"Just keep quiet," Arne says, pushing him down onto a chair. "Give me a scribble and he's all yours," the duty officer says as they leave the room.
Chapter 108. Rocky looks paler today and has dark patches under his eyes. He's probably suffering from withdrawal. Arne Mjellander sits in the adjoining room watching them, but he can't hear what they're saying.
The soundproof glass wall is intended to protect the confidentiality of conversations between defense lawyers and their clients, but also to allow the police to question suspects without the contents of their conversations leaking out.
They say they can keep me locked up in this fucking place for 6 months,
Rocky says in a gruff voice, rubbing under his nose.
You've talked about a preacher,
Yuna says, in a final attempt to avoid putting his plan into action.
I have problems with my memory after...
I know, Yuna interrupts, but try to remember the preacher. You saw him kill a woman called Tina.
That's possible,
Rocky says, his eyes narrowing.
He chopped off her arm with a machete. Do you remember that?
I don't remember anything,
Rocky whispers.
Do you know someone called Nestor?
I don't think so.
Look at this picture,
Yuna says, handing him the printout. Rocky studies Nestor's thin face carefully, then nods.
He was in Karsudan, I think.
Did you know him?
I don't know. There were different sections.
Are you prepared to meet Eric Maria Bark and let yourself be hypnotized?
Okay,
Rocky says with a shrug.
The problem is that the prosecutor is refusing to let you out,
Yuna says slowly.
Eric can always come and hypnotize me here.
That isn't possible, because the police think Eric carried out the murders.
Eric?
But he's as innocent as you were.
Vanitas vanitatum,
Rocky says with a broad smile.
Eric found Olivia, who...
I know, I know. I go down on my knees and thank him every evening. But what do you expect me to do about it?
We are leaving together, you and me,
Yuna replies calmly.
I'll take one of the guards hostage, and all you have to do is come along with me.
Hostage?
We'll be out in 7 minutes, long before the police get here.
Rocky looks at Yuna, then at Arne, sitting behind the glass.
I'll do it if I can have my wraps back,
Rocky says, leaning back and stretching his legs.
What sort of heroin was it?
Yuna asks.
White, from Nimroz, but Kandahar would do fine.
I'll sort it,
Yuna says, taking a flattened roll of duct tape from his pocket. With his eyes half closed, Rocky watches the former police officer wrap the heavy-duty tape round his hands.
I'm sure you know what you're doing,
Rocky says.
Bring the bag of sandwiches,
Yuna says, pressing the button on the intercom to indicate that the meeting is over. A few moments later, Arne opens the door and lets Yuna out into the corridor. The idea is for him to lead Yuna out of the prison, then take Rocky back to his cell. While the prison officer locks Rocky inside the interview room, Yuna goes over to the other door where the bottom of the skirting board has come loose. He leans down, slips his fingers into the gap, and pulls upwards. The screws spring free from the concrete wall along with their brown plastic roll plugs.
You can't do that!
Anne exclaims. Crumbs of cement rain down on the floor as Yuna yanks up the skirting board. The top screws are stuck, and Yuna jerks hard, twisting the metal until there's a bang as the last screws come loose.
Are you listening?
Arne says, drawing his baton. I'm talking to you. Yuna takes no notice of him. He holds the skirting board out in front of him, stamps down hard with his foot, bends down and turns it, then stamps again.
What the hell are you doing?
Arne asks with a nervous smile, coming closer.
I'm sorry,
Yuna says simply. He knows what sort of training Arne Mjellander has received, and that he's going to approach with his left hand outstretched, trying to hold him off while he attempts to strike Yuna on the thighs and upper arms with sweeping movements of the baton.
Yuna moves towards him with long strides, knocks his arm away, and then lands his elbow in the heavy man's chest, making him stagger back. His knees give way, but he puts out a hand to support himself and manages to sit down on the floor. Yuna stumbles forward from the momentum of the blow, but stays on his feet and snatches the prison officer's alarm from him before he has time to react. He cuts his lower arm as he puts the bent part of the skirting board around Arne's neck, then pulls the handcuffs from his belt and attaches one cuff to the point where the ends of the skirting board intersect. "Stand up and let Rocky out," he says. Arne coughs and turns round heavily, crawls to the wall and leans against it as he gets to his feet. "Unlock the door." Arne's hands are free, but Yuna is steering him from behind with the protruding ends of the skirting board. His neck is trapped in the noose-like bend, the sharp edges of the metal pressing against his neck.
"Don't do this," Arne pants.
Sweat is running down his face, and his hands are shaking as he unlocks the door of the interview room. Rocky comes out, picks up the baton, and presses it on the floor to make it contract again. "Arne, if you help us, we'll be out in 4 minutes, and then I let you go," Yuna says. The prison officer limps ahead of Yuna and keeps trying to slip his fingers under the metal noose. "Use your pass card and type in the code," Yuna says, steering him towards the lift. As they travel down through the building, Arne holds one hand against the mirror and keeps looking up at the camera in the hope that someone will see him. The metal has already cut through one layer of the duct tape around Yuna's hands. When they emerge into the lobby, it takes just a matter of seconds before the rest of the prison staff realize what's going on. Like a pressure wave, the atmosphere goes from relaxed to intense. Some sort of silent alarm has evidently been activated. A light is flashing beneath one desk, and prison officers who had been sitting talking moments before hurry to their feet. Chairs scrape the floor, papers fall to the ground.
"Let us through,"
Yuna calls, steering Arne towards the exit. 7 guards are approaching anxiously from the corridor. They're clearly having trouble reading the situation, and Yuna tells Rocky to watch his back. Rocky extends the baton again and walks backwards behind Yuna towards the airlock. The officer who was sitting in the security command center hurries over. His task now is to slow things down and delay the escape for as long as possible.
"I can't let you out," he says, "but if you give yourselves up, then look at your colleagues."